John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, November 9, 2011. The Russell Tribunal finds Israel guilty of apartheid, and the International Quartet Committee announced plans for the resumption of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. These stories and more coming up, so stay tuned. The Russell Tribunal on Palestine has ruled that Israel is guilty of apartheid and prosecution crimes. The tribunal held extensive talks for 2 days and unanimously determined that the Israeli violations are defined under international law as apartheid, stating that, quote, Israel subjects the Palestinians to institutionalized regime of domination mounting to apartheid, end quote. They called on the United Nations General Assembly to hold a special session to investigate Israel's apartheid policies against the Palestinian people. This comes as the International Quartet Committee announced that it will be holding separate meetings with Palestine and Israeli leaders in an effort to restart peace talks. The quartet has been trying to negotiate proposals meant to reduce the gap between the stances of Israel and the Palestinian Authority on issues related to security arrangements, settlements, and the efforts to ensure the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. In other news, Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party has filed a draft for a new law that calls for enforcing more restrictions on foreign funding to Arab organizations and leftist groups in the country. Analysts believe Netanyahu is trying to appease the country's right-wing groups following the Israeli government's removal of illegal settlements in the West Bank. These same right-wing groups attacked the home of Israeli Peace Now movement member Hagit Ofran, spraying swastikas and graffiti on her home. It is worth mentioning that the Peace Now office in Jerusalem was vandalized earlier this week, and a bomb threat was reported on Sunday. The Star of David was also sprayed on the gates of the office. Over in the Gaza Strip, the Israeli Air Force has carried out airstrikes near Khan Yunis. 2 missiles were fired into the area, with a number of residents suffering minor injuries, with no reports of casualties. In international news, fissures appear in the relationship between Israel and South Korea, after Tel Aviv considers scrapping a US $1 billion arms deal. South Korea is outraged after learning that Israel has signed a preliminary agreement with Italy to purchase new training planes. Seoul has hinted that reneging of the deal would result in the annulment of all previously signed Israeli-Korean arms procurements, worth an estimated $280 million per year to Israel. Pressure has increased on Iran following the International Atomic Energy Agency's report suggesting that Tehran may have been undertaking activities to develop nuclear weapons. The West has called for increased sanctions on the Islamic Republic, while Israel has not ruled out military intervention. That's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, November 9th daily roundup of news from the occupied Palestinian territories. We hope you will join us again tomorrow. This was brought to you by Bossam Kassis and myself, Adam Carey.
The story of Freedom Flotilla 2 to Gaza, which began last summer with boats blockaded in Greek ports as they were planning to sail to Gaza and challenge Israel's blockade, continues. On Friday, the 4th of November, pirates of the Israeli Navy again boarded boats of a Gaza relief flotilla. Again, the boardings were in international waters, which is as pirate as this radio station. The two boats, one from Canada and one from Ireland, were carrying 27 passengers, including peace activists and the press from Ireland, Canada, the United States, Australia, and Palestine. These were unarmed boats, and the Israeli military knew it, but sent the military to stop them anyway. Few have forgotten the 9 activists from Turkey who were killed aboard the Mavi Mara when Israeli troopers rappelled down to the boat from a helicopter and attacked firing guns. All this because Israel insists on continuing to blockade Gaza, Palestine, blocking even construction materials from entering. Afghanistan, Saturday. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Sunday. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in western Afghanistan. Afghanistan, today. All Afghan government soldiers working in a patrol base in southern Afghanistan have been disarmed and confined to barracks after one of them turned his weapon on Australian troops, seriously injuring 3 of them. The incident in Uruzgan province is the latest attack on Western troops by members of Afghanistan's security forces. Officials say the Afghanistan National Army soldier was standing on a raised watchtower in a patrol base when he opened fire with an automatic weapon and grenade launcher, shooting down into the interior of the compound. This sort of thing has been going on since Afghan insurgents were fighting the Soviet Union in the 1980s. Afghanistan, last night. A major battle was fought in Paktia province when insurgents attacked NATO bases in Barmal district. NATO says the insurgents were using small arms and RPGs and that their counterattack with airstrikes killed 60 to 70 insurgent fighters. They claim no NATO fighters were wounded or killed, but they are not talking about property damage at all. Afghanistan, Friday. Major General Peter Fuller has been relieved of his duties as a deputy commander for the Afghan training mission. He publicly called Afghan leaders, quote, erratic, ungrateful, and isolated from reality, putting his own commander, General John R. Allen, the commander of NATO forces in Afghanistan, in rather a tight spot. He even went so far as to say that Afghans, quote, don't appreciate America's sacrifice, in mostly economic terms, when it is Afghan government troops, not U.S. troops, who are killed in most insurgent attacks, and the war is fought on their soil. Iraq. Yesterday, U.S. troops finally returned to U.S. airbase known as Joint Base Balad to Iraqi control. Saladin Province, Iraq. Today, another pro-Iraqi government, Al-Sawa, or Awakening Force commander was killed by a bomb planted under his car, according to a police source. The Sawa, or Awakening Fighters, are former insurgents who switched sides to support the U.S. in 2007 and are regarded by current insurgents as traitors. Kirkuk, Iraq, Saturday. A U.S. patrol was attacked by a bomb, but no casualties were reported, according to a security source reporting to Oswald Al Iraq News Agency. Wait a minute! What U.S. patrol? What bomb? I thought U.S. combat operations in Iraq were over! Oh yeah! That's been said before! Mr. Barack Obama, your permit to occupy Iraq runs out on the 31st of December, and you say all U.S. troops will be home by then. What's the point to combat operations now? For that matter, what makes you think things will be any different in Afghanistan? Now's the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com.
Large U.S.-based multinational corporations, including Apple, Oracle, and Pfizer, are lobbying Congress for a tax holiday on $1 trillion they hold overseas. The corporate lobbying effort, endorsed by over 70 members of Congress, including leading Democrats like Senator Barbara Boxer, say the holiday would bring billions of dollars back to America and boost new investment and jobs. On the flip side, the tax holiday could cost American taxpayers $40 to $80 billion over the next decade. Studies suggest that over 70% of the money returned to the U.S. would end up as bonuses for top corporate executives or in the pockets of shareholders. During a 2004 tax repatriation holiday, corporate earnings returned from overseas were taxed at 5.25% instead of the standard 35% corporate income tax rate. Critics in Congress, like Michigan Senator Carl Levin, complain that such tax holidays punish companies that rely on domestic production. According to the Center for Public Integrity, the bulk of tax benefits from the 2004 tax holiday went to 15 big corporations. By themselves, Pfizer, Merck, Hewlett-Packard, Johnson & Johnson, and IBM brought back $88 billion in corporate cash to the U.S. at the reduced tax rate. A U.S. Senate investigation discovered that Intel and Coca-Cola used shell companies in the Cayman Islands to hide corporate cash. Tax analyst Charles Kingson said the tax holiday, quote, rewards those who have beaten the tax system. What Intel or GE or Pfizer does not pay, other people and their children will.
With thousands of new activists participating in hundreds of encampments across the nation each week, the Occupy Wall Street movement is moving forward, even if the eventual goals and list of demands are not yet clear. The November 2nd general strike in Oakland, California, called on short notice to respond to police violence, organized thousands of activists to march downtown and close down the city's busy container port. Many observers were struck by the success of that citywide action and diversity of participants, demonstrating the power of this new movement that wasn't even in existence just 2 short months ago. Now, with ongoing police challenges to occupy encampments in dozens of cities and towns, derisive media stories focusing on drug use and sex, and preparations for the cold winter ahead, many activists are sitting down to contemplate longer-term strategies on how to grow the movement and more effectively disseminate their message protesting corporate greed, political corruption, and economic inequality. Many longtime progressive activists and intellectuals from across the U.S. have offered support to the Occupy movement and have visited encampments to conduct teach-ins and provide advice if asked. Ralph Nader is among them. The three-time independent presidential candidate credits this new movement with changing the national conversation from one focused on austerity to unaccountable corporate crime and abuse. The protesters' grievances echo Nader's primary message through his five-decade career as a consumer advocate, citizen activist, and candidate. Your reporter spoke with Ralph Nader about his impressions of the Occupy Wall Street movement and the threat it poses to the political and economic status quo.
Well, I think it's the early stages of repealing a long-repressed demand for justice. You can't live in this country and see all those great reports on corporate crime and the control over our government and big money buying politicians and Wall Street crashes on the backs of workers and investors and taxpayer bailouts without having that, start churning your core of decency and what you think a fair play is among people in a country like ours. And I think this came out of nowhere in the sense that no one could really have predicted this. I wrote a column, and you can see it on Nader.org, a few months ago, right after the Tunisian breakthrough and Egyptian breakthrough. And I said, you never know where the spark's going to come from. And when it comes, people are going to say, wow, how amazing. What took it so long? Well, the spark basically was young people, usually starts with people in their 20s who are willing to camp out and march and engage in nonviolent civil disobedience and be arrested. And they took over public space. They took over the commons. And in so doing now, they planted themselves in dozens and dozens of communities, right down to Niles, Michigan, which has 12,000 people. And their signs indicate what they are going for, which is a broad range of justice, the deconcentration of corporate power, the end of the bailouts, a complete shift of public budget priorities to the needs and necessities of tens of millions of Americans, a public works program, getting out of those criminal wars. I mean, this is a very fundamental movement, so much so that some of the Tea Partiers who visited the Occupy New York area in Zuccotti Park were ready for a friendly argument, and they went away agreeing with the Occupy Wall Street people on about five major issues.
Ralph, we've just saw on November 5th a transfer of over 600,000 accounts from the big banks to smaller community banks and credit unions. In your opinion, are the elite powers that be in the U.S. threatened by the Occupy Wall Street movement, and how seriously do they take the threat presented by this movement to the economic and political status quo?
Well, I think some of them made fun of the movement at the beginning, and others, I think, felt that they had some grievance. You had some surprising statements of approval by some Republicans. But I think now, Scott, they're beginning to sweat a bit. I think when they see movements away from big banks to community banks, that's language these big bankers understand. And if it wasn't for the fact that so many people who have these bank accounts also have electronic payment connections where their electric and telephone and other bills are paid electronically, it would be much easier to move. So it takes a while for them to disconnect, and that's why it's so impressive that 650,000 people in less than 2 months have moved away from these banks to credit unions. And if that starts going and more people vote with their consumer feet, they're not going to be laughing anymore. These business bosses will be starting to buy more underarm deodorant.
That's good for them. It could be good for the cosmetic industry, too, I guess. I wanted to ask your opinion on the targeting of Congress. You recently wrote a column suggesting that the Occupy Wall Street movement might encircle the offices of members of Congress, especially those ones who are standing in the way of some common sense reforms and structural changes to this very unfair system. What's your view on that?
Yeah, I think that's the next stage. They're looking for more Occupy sites for demonstrations, and I'm urging them, because they are so decentralized, the Occupy initiatives, to surround many of the 535 offices of their senators and representatives back home. And, just look in the phone book under U.S. Congress, and you'll see where they are, the offices. And you surround them just the way 10,000 people surrounded the White House to try to persuade President Obama to block the XL pipeline. And I think if they do that, the bubble in Congress, I mean, Congress has hardly felt this. I mean, they're still going about their oligarchic and plutocratic and narcissistic and ignorant activities there on Capitol Hill. They haven't yet felt it, but I think that's the next stage that they should go through. These people are very computer savvy. They've lived for years in virtual reality, looking at screens, and now they know that the action really is in physical reality. It's in reality on the ground, here, there, everywhere. If they maintain their discipline and their nonviolent, open civil disobedience, they will continue to generate that kind of moral authority.
That was Ralph Nader, consumer advocate, citizen activist, and three-time independent presidential candidate. His newest book is titled Getting Steam to Overcome Corporatism, Build It Together to Win. Find links to Nader's commentaries and information on the Occupy Wall Street movement on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
On the 4th of November, Occupy DC marches from their base in McPherson Square to the Washington Convention Center to lay siege to the Koch brothers-funded American Dream Summit with blockades of the Washington Convention Center's doors and the surrounding streets. Occupy DC's march is joining with the other unit in this parking lot. In a teens unit over there, projecting onto the walls of the Washington Convention Center. Yeah! Wouldn't we all? I heard that. Yeah! It's the evil thing. After the movie, things got hot and heavy with protesters dropping blockades all the way around the convention center. The first objective was to block all of the streets by which it's possible to access the convention center by vehicle. This cop just about hit somebody. Doesn't work very well and the crowd gets hemmed in. You hit somebody with a car, people weren't too happy about it. Nobody was hurt. It wasn't much of an impact, but you pay for that. A circle of people sitting down. Here's a ninth and K under control. And while other groups have taken over the streets, the doors of the convention center are also blockaded by protests. There's at least Team 4 deploying ahead. Approaching the Washington Convention Center.
here has become very difficult with so many street blockades in place. They're allowed to pass since they're leaving, but we're not going to let anybody in. The Santa Cadillac Escalade will not be permitted to pass. The crowd is not going to allow our wealthy Cadillac Escalade, a car that belongs to the 1%, to come through the lines. The siege lines are absolute against wealthy people that drive things like that. We've got another team deploying to another intersection. Got another team holding this intersection. 9th and L. Cops aren't letting traffic on 9th Street. We've got another blockade up here. There's a report that's a lockdown somewhere. This is a nice strong blockade. We're at M Street and 9th Street. It's 8:41, 20 minutes till the right wingers try to come out. This is a strong testament blockade. Let's see if we got a blockade here or not. Yes, we do. Blockade number 6, that's Team 6, baby. Team 6 holding strong. Possible assault with a motor vehicle.
That time they were lucky and nobody got hurt. That luck will change later.
What an expensive car. It's 20 minutes, it's 9:20, 20 minutes after the nominal end of their event. Street barricades are holding strong. Not a good day for the Koch brothers. More of the attendees leaving. Have to run the gauntlet to get out. Metro 2. Is that how the 1%ers are getting out?
This one.
It was during this time that one DC cop got way out of line, getting a woman in a chokehold when she was trying to protect young children.
The video was like kids in there.
Stop killing our children. Hey,
that's right, he said stop moving or I'll choke ya.
It's been almost an hour since the end of the Koch brothers event.
Convention goers are going out the front door in droves.
Here they are. Yeah, get the word out. We got people holding the line and they're thin everywhere. Battle at the front door.
We say fight back. We say fight back.
The first time I've seen all cops.
With the front door blocked, things started getting nasty at the back door.
Oh, hold it, hold it. Strong and firm, baby.
Just lock the door.
Just smile and hold the door. We don't need that.
Lock it. Yeah. They try to come out this way. Doesn't work.
Accused Occupy DC of pushing a woman to the ground during one of these confrontations, only to have video emerge a few days later proving the cops were lying and that the woman was actually pushed to the ground by a man in a suit and tie scrambling out of the convention center. One carload of attendees rammed into protesters, accelerating hard, fled down the street with myself in pursuit, turned the corner from L Street on to 7th Street, rammed through another blockade of protesters, wounding three more people before finally being stopped by a mix of traffic, protesters, and cops. He could have killed somebody. This guy could have fucking killed somebody.
Go back up on the curb.
And we have an ambulance for the wounded. And fire truck. The police not only refused to ticket or arrest the driver, they ticketed the three people who were run over at the second barricade and even had the nerve to show up in the hospital to ticket someone who had been seriously hurt by this fleeing hit-and-run willful assault with a motor vehicle driver. They're attacking one of us! They attack one of us! They attack us! The police arrest one of us after one of our people hit by a car.
Two of our people now. I watched both people get hit by that one fucking car.
Yeah, we have two people hit by cars. Now we have somebody arrested trying to do something about it. Let him go or arrest the driver or face us. In the aftermath of this came a series of dueling press conferences. The police called the press conference but were late to show up, giving Occupy DC a chance to seize the microphone and tell their side of the story.
If I could just have a second, I'm Heidi Sipple. Myself and my son Landon Sipple were the pedestrians that were struck last night. I just wanted to say that we were struck last night and tell you what happened to us. The police have refused to take our statements. In the hospital last night, I was issued my citations while I was being wheeled into CT, and the officer wouldn't speak to me then. So hopefully I'll get some answers today too. Myself and my family are from a little north of Dayton, Ohio, and we came to DC to take my son to the Smithsonian and the different museums and see some of the sites. We came also to participate in Occupy DC because I wanted him to see what democracy looked like and to participate in a movement that his voice could be heard. We did this to be completely peaceful. My wife, who is 6 months pregnant at the end of February, have had long talks about coming out here. We chose DC because it was the most peaceful of all of the rallies in the area. We're at the corner of New York and 7th Street. We arrived there like a little after 7 o'clock, and we had been there for almost 3 hours. We had about 50 people at that intersection. Police were essentially blocking the traffic for us, and we could be there just as a visual for the people inside. At a little after 10 o'clock, we were standing in our line where we had been for many hours, when a car came barreling down 7th Street, traveling, I think, southbound in the northbound lane, but on the wrong side of the road, right towards myself and my family. When he got to the intersection, he stopped, came to a complete stop, just for a split second, and a lot of cars that had previously come to that point would have either turned around or gave us a second to get out of the way. We were never at any point violent or hitting cars or blocking it. We let ambulances and buses and other cars through. He stopped at that same point in the intersection, and we all watched very carefully to see what he would do. And at that point, he threw his hands up off of his steering wheel and gassed it, just gunned it right through us. Luckily, my wife was able to get mostly out of the way. My son was in front of the car, and I saw him be struck, and he was trying to step backwards very quickly to stay out from underneath the car. And it bent him over and slammed him down on the hood. At this point, I realized that if we did not get out from in front of this car very quickly, that we were going to be underneath it very soon because the driver was not letting up on the gas whatsoever, even after he struck us. I took my son and I shoved him as hard as I could one direction, and I dove the other direction. The car hit my legs and I hit the ground, hit my head, and briefly lost consciousness.
The car came down the street at us and it stopped, threw its hands up, and as soon as it had got his hands back on the steering wheel, he just gunned it, and I ended up, when he hit me, it bent me at the waist, and I fell over and smacked my head on the hood of the car, and I went like 10 feet back, and then my mom finally got me off, like, pushed me off the hood.
The other thing that you should know is that before this gentleman struck me, he hit another woman at an intersection around the corner. She was also taken to the hospital with injuries to her head. The same incident has been described to me by her that happened to us. So this happened repeatedly.
We just wanted to say that both of us were there last night. We both saw both collisions. So we can take any questions you might have about them.
What did you see?
Georgia and some others were standing under the skywalk by the DC, by the Washington Convention Center, and then he just went into Georgia and missed the other people. I figured this guy would stop. No one would ever do that on purpose. But then he kind of just kept going. Where he hit Georgia was not an intersection. It was the crosswalk under the skywalk at the Washington, D.C. Convention Center.
So no lights there at all?
There's no traffic lights.
The green light thing.
On Monday, the 7th of November, Occupy D.C. staged a press conference under the L Street overpass of the Convention Center where the car assault began and marched to the police station, leading to what the Washington Post described as a tense half-hour standoff before a delegation was permitted inside to deliver their grievances. Supposedly, a police investigation into this incident has finally been opened. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. On the 8th of November, Occupy D.C., still furious about Friday night's motorist and police violence at the existing convention center, joined forces with the laborers to lay siege to a Clark Construction job site where the old convention center used to stand because of Clark's refusal to hire D.C.'s African-American construction workers.
Job this morning,
as soon as Occupy D.C. took the streets, car cops, motorcycle cops, and even horse cops warmed in to push everybody back to the sidewalk. Cops getting aggressive. Horse cops, everything. They really don't like it. Pouring into the street. Yet all those cops couldn't stop Occupy D.C. and the laborers from arriving at Clark's job site where the old convention center used to be.
They don't work.
It looks like we're on target at Clark Construction's site here off New York Avenue.
We don't work.
Team 2 coming around. Jobs or else.
That's right.
Yeah. This is the third entrance. All three of the entrances to this site are going to be closed.
Nothing goes in, nothing goes out.
That includes those big trucks. It's one thing to ram somebody with a car, but try that with this big Peterbilt that you gotta have a commercial driver's license to drive. Good luck keeping that CDL after a ramming incident. And that's the third entrance there. All
all three entrances are besieged. There's no way in or out of this site except by passing to construct siege lines. All these cops can't stop the siege except by using raw force. This is the New York Avenue entrance. Pretty solidly held. This is the parking area. We've got a number of pickups in here and SUVs. One or two smaller cars and one larger truck. They're not going to be getting out through this gate. Leave. There's a driver in the truck with the M107 on the fender. However, there's no way these trucks are getting out.
And in fact, nothing got in or out until the protesters left.
The Congressional Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction, known as the Congressional Super Committee, was formed in a deal reached to break the impasse over raising the nation's debt ceiling in August. The Super Committee, composed of 6 Democrats and 6 Republicans, half from the House and half from the Senate, are tasked with reducing the nation's deficit by at least $1.2 trillion over the next 10 years by making budget cuts and/or increasing revenue. The panel's members must reach an agreement on a deficit reduction plan by November 23rd, which would then be voted on by the full Congress. If the panel cannot broker a deal, that failure would trigger automatic cuts by the same amount in both domestic and defense spending in the 2013 federal budget. The odds against the committee reaching a deal are high, since GOP lawmakers have rejected all tax hikes on the wealthy that President Obama and Democratic legislators say must be linked to any major cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Because of the enormous amounts of money at stake in these negotiations for defense contractors, health insurance companies, and other special interests, their lobbyists are working feverishly to influence the outcome of the Super Committee's mostly secret deliberations. Your reporter spoke with Ellen Miller, co-founder and executive director of the Sunshine Foundation. Miller explains why her group is advocating for full disclosure of all campaign contributions received and meetings held between lobbyists and members of the Super Committee or their staff during the critical final weeks of the panel's negotiations.
Some, I believe, that the task set to the Super Committee is so enormous that there's almost no one who will be unaffected. I mean, we're talking about the figure I tend to use is $1.2 trillion that either will have to be cut or raised through new revenues. That's a lot of money. That will mean that every program we care about, whether it's Social Security or health care or schools or defense, across the board, there will be a dramatic change in the amount of government money that is going to support these kinds of programs. So every one of us should be concerned, and every one of us should have the opportunity to comment to our representatives about how we think this should happen. But in fact, the committee is operating outside the reach of public oversight. It's having mostly secret hearings. Occasionally they've had a few window dressing hearings where they are open to the public. But the decisions are all being made behind closed doors, except to those who can afford to hire lobbyists. and those who can afford to give big campaign contributions. So it's really critical, we think, for all Americans to have the ability to track online in real time the lobbying activities and every dollar of campaign contributions that are coming into committee's members, because we are concerned that the lobbyists with their campaign money will have a determinative outcome on the decisions that are made. We don't know whether that's true or not, but without real transparency, 21st century style transparency, we will always suspect that that's the case. And so we're anxious for the committee members to comply with what we've asked for, which would be voluntary, to list all of their campaign contributions and all their meetings with lobbyists every single day that they're meeting.
Ellen Miller, the super committee has on its docket to consider major cuts in defense spending as well as social safety net programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. What are the institutions and corporations in this country that have a vested interest in determining the outcome of what this super committee recommends?
We know that in the first quarter that, you know, $100,000 has been raised in contributions to 10 of the 12 members of the super committee or their leadership PACs. We know that there are now over 600 lobby registrants that have listed the Budget Control Act, which was the act that actually set up the super committee, as something they're lobbying on. 600 lobby registrants. I mean, imagine the pressure that these members of Congress are under. We know that some of the largest lobbying groups involve healthcare organizations, communications and electronic industries, the finance and insurance industry. You know, those are the top three that are lobbying. But everyone is there. Everyone who has the potential of either having taxes raised on them or programs cut is lobbying this committee. Now, to some degree, one might say if everyone is there, then everyone is represented. But in fact, you know, most people are not represented by these heavy-hitting big corporations. Most people aren't represented at all when it comes to role of money in politics. I looked at this figure earlier today and realized that less than 1% of Americans make a campaign contribution of $1,000. But that money is determinative in terms of who gets elected. And so, you know, if you have big money to give or to hire high-paid lobbyists, you obviously are getting better representation in this process.
Ellen, what are you suggesting right now in terms of disclosure from the members of the super committee so that the public will have a better idea of the moneyed interests and the influence that they're wielding on the members of this committee? They're going to make some really major decisions for the near-term and long-term future of the country.
Well, we've asked for really three very simple things. Number one, for members of the super committee to voluntarily disclose their campaign contributions, to voluntarily disclose their lobbying contacts, the meetings they're having, and finally, to post their recommendations 72 hours before the final committee vote so that people understand what's in the bill, they can read the legislation, and they can contact their members of Congress and tell them what they think about it. So three very simple things. Put your campaign contributions online in real time, tell us who you're meeting with, and put the legislation online so we can look at it before you vote on it. But there's a general reluctance from members of Congress to call on other members of Congress, in fact, to disclose what they really don't want to disclose. For the very same reasons we want the information, which is we want the information so we can demand accountability, members of Congress are reluctant to give us that information.
That was Ellen Miller, co-founder and executive director of the Sunshine Foundation. Learn more about the Sunshine Foundation's campaign for government transparency by visiting our website at btlonline.org.
On the 20th of September, I received a robotic survey call from the Consumer Energy Alliance. They started with two questions, quote, do you believe gas prices are too high? And quote, do you believe unemployment is too high? Recognizing that this had to be a fake industry push-pull, I answered no to both questions, even though Wall Street has indeed thrown far too many people out of work. I then managed to start recording the rest of this phony so-called survey microphone to telephone. Turns out the whole survey is about pressuring the Department of State to approve that nasty tar sands oil pipeline that 1,250 people were arrested in front of the White House saying no to. Here's what my microphone got.
Reduce U.S. dependence on imports from the Middle East. To build this importing pipeline, TransCanada must receive a permit from the Department of State that will allow it to cross the border from Canada to the U.S. The Department of State is currently soliciting public comments on whether to grant the permit and allow TransCanada to build the pipeline and put thousands of Americans to work. May we have your permission to relay your support for this vital pipeline?
No, you may not. I oppose the pipeline, and I wish the project would be blocked.
Please say yes, no, repeat, now.
No.
Would you like more information on
oil
and gas production and the jobs that it can create?
No.
Are you male?
Yes.
Are you 50 years of age or older?
No.
Thank you for your time and views. This survey was conducted by the Consumer Energy Alliance. Goodbye. 7-1.
I should have gotten the recording more quickly.
It looks to me like the Consumer Energy Alliance is desperate to keep alive our bad romance with fossil fuels and dirty oil. No, I wasn't going to let them falsely tell the Department of State that I support the filthy Alberta tar sands mining. I'd rather see gasoline cost $10 a gallon than support a pipeline whose contributions to global warming is going to flood every coastal city, including mine. Of November, an estimated 12,000 people surrounded the White House all the way around, demanding that President Obama reject the permit for the Keystone XL tar sands oil pipeline. The minister speaking at the event compared oil to an addiction.
An addiction? You gotta call for an intervention. Bill, this campaign is an intervention in the soul.
Monday, the 7th of November, just one day after this protest, it was announced that there would be a special review of the State Department's scandal-ridden permitting process on the Keystone XL pipeline, where one of the key decision-makers turned out to be somebody who had previously worked for TransCanada. Now the whole thing's going to be reviewed. Let's never forget that opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline began with Native American people whose lands were directly threatened, and they were present as the White House was completely surrounded on the 6th of November. As a sudden announcement of a State Department review has proven, yes, we can stop this pipeline. Mr. Obama, the decision is in your hands.